Welcome, and thanks for listening to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic cell transplant and other cell therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, provider education and research lead at NMDP. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Rachel Phelan of the Medical College of Wisconsin and Dr. Rafiq Youssef of NMDP, who both act as scientific directors for the CIBMTR, or Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research. Together, we discuss the results of a recent CIBMTR report examining trends in allogeneic transplant by race and ethnicity. We explore the advances in transplant that have helped to close gaps in equity, as well as the multifaceted barriers that continue to hinder equitable access and outcomes. To learn more about our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, click the link in the episode description. This is part one of a two-part episode. All right. So I am here today with Dr. Rachel Phelan and Dr. Rafiq Youssef. Thank you both so much for joining me on Explore Cell Therapy.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me too.
Of course. So today we're discussing a recent report from the Centers for International Blood and Marrow Transplantation Research, or CIBMTR, that you both worked on examining trends by race and ethnicity in utilization and outcomes for patients receiving allogeneic hematopoietic cell transplant. We know that racial inequities exist, obviously, in access and outcomes across healthcare, and transplant has certainly been no exception to that. So with that in mind, I'd love if one of you would start by discussing the goals of this real-world analysis that you conducted. You know, what's the importance of monitoring these trends?
Sure, I can start. So every year at CIBMTR, we try to put together summary slides for the entire community to use in their research, presentations, grant preparations, et cetera, that focuses on different trends in transplantation over time. And for this particular study, we decided to not only report just general trends in transplantation, but also to focus on how we may or may not see changes in utilization across different races and ethnicities.
I mean, I agree totally with Rachel. You know, specific to this review, it was, you know, one, to determine whether use of alternate donor platforms, you know, has increased access to allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplant, particularly, you know, with the novel development of using post-transplantation cyclophosphamide for prophylaxis. Then also to assess whether outcomes among ethnically diverse patients were comparable to those of non-Hispanic whites.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I'm curious, you know, taking a bit of a step back, I think maybe we could talk a little bit about, you know, what are some of those major barriers you mentioned? You mentioned post-transplant cyclophosphamide and advances that have helped to expand access, but what are those gaps that we were seeing really that you know, PTCy and mismatched donors are starting to fill? What are those major barriers that exist for racially and ethnically diverse patients that we're trying to overcome?
Yeah, so I think obviously people who are joining in on the podcast know about NMDP and Be the Match and the how amazing the registry is and that there's thousands of donors that we can access. But we also know that there are certain races and ethnicities that have less access to well-matched donors in the registry. So, for instance, patients of African-American ancestry, I believe, only have about a 29% chance of finding a well-matched donor in the registry. And it's much higher for patients that are white. And so we want to make sure that all patients really have access to transplantation for whatever reason they may require it. So because there's a gap in access to well-matched donors in the registry, it's very important that we look at different donors that may be able to fill that gap. One type of donor that's increasing greatly in use over the last few years, actually there is only 6% in 2013 and now 24% in 2020, is the use of haploidentical donors. So we've really seen a really big boom in that. And when we have donors that aren't well matched, we then have to decide how we can prevent complications related to not having a well-matched donor. And that major complication that we deal with is graft versus host disease.
I mean, I agree completely, Rachel, in the sense that, you know, I mean, if you look at barriers generally to patients, you would have the clinical or the the HLA related barriers, like you've just talked about, where you're considering donor availability in terms of HLA matching. Then you still have another whole host of non-HLA or non-medical barriers that, you know, you can look at different stakeholder levels. Is it, at the patient's level, where patients you're referring to as recipients? Is it, yes, as at the donor level or donor related, like you've mentioned? Is it caregiver related? Then, of course, you have issues that surround referring physicians or community physicians that would ought to refer patients upon diagnosis to transplant centers. Then there are transplant center related factors. So there's a whole complement. Some of those major patient-related barriers include issues around socioeconomic status. And socioeconomic status, you know, when you're looking at these stakeholder groups, you are thinking in terms of social determinants of health-related factors, of which socioeconomic factors is a subset. So within socioeconomic factors, you talk about employment, level of education. In some quarters, you know, they've also talked about social class, but how you determine that, you know, is anyone's guess. Even issues around ground transportation to, you know, the transplant centers, housing, either permanent housing or even short-term housing that the patient, you know, relocating to the transplant centers. Most transplant centers are affiliated with academic medical centers. So you have issues, you know, for patients traveling to those centers to get transplant and even for post-transplant follow-up care. Issues around insurance coverage, where you have commercial or private insurance versus public insurance, Medicare, Medicaid. Those issues, you know, health literacy, as far as the patients are concerned, where you talk about, you know, understanding the processes, consent, you know, cultural preferences. In spite of, you know, patients understanding that it's life-saving, they might still go ahead and tell you that they don't want to do that. I know I've been part of a group where we're involved in solid organ transplant, and the patients refused because they felt that, you know, if you had something taken out or somebody else's organ, and in this case, you know, either peripheral stem cells or peripheral blood or bone marrow, they feel that in the afterlife, they are not going to come back complete, that they won't be their whole self. So based off of those ideologies and religious beliefs, they don't opt for, you know, transplant, in spite of the fact that it's life-saving. Then even where these patients reside in terms of neighborhood poverty, there are studies that have shown that, you know, if you live in a high poverty area, the chances of accessing, you know, transplantation is low. you know, donor-related factors. You mentioned donor availability, but even the donors themselves have associated social determinants of health-related factors. You know, can they take time off work? You know, are they healthy? What are their, you know, socioeconomic status such that even to get them to sign up to be on the registry is an issue. When they do sign up, to get them to say yes, when they get that call. Those are other issues that, you know, need to be taken care of. Yeah, caregivers too. There have been, you know, studies around caregiver burnout and caregiver availability. Community providers, you know, hematology oncologists have their own biases based on their experiences, their knowledge. So they may tend not to refer this patient based on, you know, perhaps what their perception of the patient's age. And we know that age is not, you know, a rate limiting step to patients getting transplant. Issues around insurance coverage and risk. Even at the transplant centers, what are those eligibility criteria? You know, some transplant centers will say, if you don't have a caregiver, you can't, you know, proceed with transplant. So, you know, even manpower and is the center capacity are important issues. So you have this mix of non-clinical or non-HLA and HLA related barriers that all come together to, you know, impact the patient accessing and utilizing the life-saving transplant.
Yeah, Rafiq, those are such important, great points that you just made. I felt like I jumped right into the patient being in my office and talking about picking a donor, right? But the patient has to get to the office, and there's so many things that can make that not happen, right? And I think it's also important to talk about, you know, the use of haploidentical transplantation has increased significantly over time. Like I talked about, same as our ability to use mismatched unrelated donors as well. But at the same time, certain treatment centers may be more or less comfortable with using those donor types as well, or they may only be available if the patient enrolls on a clinical trial. And we know that there's also a lot of discrepancies in clinical trial enrollment based on race and ethnicity and cultural factors and all of those types of things too. So really, really important points that you just made. And I echo all of that as being really critical.
It sounds like there are a lot of changes happening in the field. There's a lot of progress that's being made, particularly on the HLA barriers side of things, for sure. But this slew of other barriers that affect all patients on their journey to transplant in differing ways can certainly affect those who are racially and ethnically diverse more so than others. I'm curious, so I know you mentioned the trends in haploidentical transplant, and you mentioned mismatch unrelated donor transplant. What other major trends did you find in the analysis? Were you able to get at any of the socioeconomic factors or things like that? Or how did you really break things down to try to get a pulse on what's going on in the field right now?
I think, you know, and it's up for discussion. Most of the analysis here is, you know, the immediate transplant and, you know, post-transplant period. So most of the comparison that were done based off of race, off of sex. You know, so that kind of limits the inferences that you can make based off of, you know, all these other social determinants of health-related factors. And I think, you know, again, there's more interest, at least increasing interest in looking at those factors, because essentially they provide some context into, you know, some of these numbers. Like Rachel said, the patient needs to walk through the door to come in for that, you know, consultation. So what are those both upstream and downstream factors that you know, would affect the patients eventually walking through through the doors. So some of the those type of data elements are in the process of being captured, you know, and included in this summary analysis. And I think that just speaks to part of the progress.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a huge part of it is awareness of everybody in the community, right? So, you know, we are embedded in the, you know, stem cell transplant world, and we know this data, we know we need to make improvements. We also know that we have improved ways to administer transplants to all patients, but people who are referring patients to transplant may not be aware of the progress that we've made and the capabilities that we have. So having transplant referral guidelines that I know that NMDP has posted on their website, as well as many other guidelines that have been developed and put out into the world, are extremely important. I know that we've personally seen a huge increase in referrals for patients with sickle cell disease to consider transplant since ASH put out their transplant guidelines for referral. So all of those things can make a huge difference in terms of, again, getting the patient in the door and having access and, you know, at least being able to have that discussion about transplant eligibility and transplant capabilities that are present at any center.
So I'm curious, you know, we talked about haploidentical transplants and mismatch unrelated donor transplants increasing in frequency. Are those trends aligning with increased utilization across racial and ethnic groups in the analysis? Is that something that you found? And how have outcomes overall changed over time based on the real world data that you looked at?
I mean, I'll take a stab at that in the sense that, yes, ethnically diverse patients, by virtue of, you know, using these alternative donor platforms, have had access, more access. And, you know, the summary analysis shows that. And most of them, the alternative platform ads we've been talking about is, you know, mismatch unrelated donor and haploidentical. And by extension too, you know, overall survival rates have improved across all races and ethnicities, you know, particularly in the last, decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the last couple decades, there's been huge improvements in supportive cares, transplantation techniques, graft versus host disease prophylaxis, and then just, you know, HLA typing, our capabilities to do high resolution typing, where we can type at, all of that. And even though we have had improvements in access to different donor types because of different graft versus host disease prophylaxis techniques, such as post-transplant cyclophosphamide or alpha-beta T-cell depletion is another one that's used. We did see in this analysis that there still is an increased risk of graft versus host disease in racially and ethnically diverse patients. And it's likely because even though we only match at specific alleles, there's certain ones that may not be matched as well that we aren't typing for or looking at. So progress still needs to be made in that area in terms of, you know, continuing to improve what we have available for graft versus host disease prevention and then eventual treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely. And, you know, it's a testament to the advancement in science of, you know, transplantation and cellular therapy and, you know, more clinical trials opening up to try and understand, you know, this kind of situation. So, and even for non-malignant blood disorders like sickle cell disease, one of the commonest ways patients access is through clinical trials. You know, so there's a lot of advancement as far as the, you know, the science is concerned. And that being said, you'd look at, it's going to be a holistic view, so to speak, of, yes, this the science-related issues and the non-science-related issues, such that, you know, if we're advancing in the science, and part of this summary analysis has shown that in spite of this improved access and utilization, you still have, you know, inequities or disparities that still need to be addressed. So I think it's a continuous a process, and it essentially requires all hands being on deck.
Right. Yeah. And Rafiq, even though you noted, you know, and that this study shows that there were an increased number of racially and ethnically diverse patients that underwent transplantation, I think we'd all like to see those numbers growing at a higher and faster rate, right? So that's more in line with the actual population. And, you know, even though we have the ability to do these transplants now with different types of donors and T cell depletion and, you know, GVHD prophylaxis and prevention, again, there are barriers that we need to work on and identify in getting those patients here, getting them enrolled on trials, you know, getting those referrals in, basically that whole host of things that you talked about earlier that are really making it hard for us to allow those patients to access the care that they need.
I was just going to add that, you know, it speaks to the multifaceted nature of understanding what these issues are and being able to address them, such that we don't look at it as just a healthcare system problem. You know, I mean, the justice system, the transportation system, the agricultural, you know, sector, all of the sectors come to play, you know, criminal justice and all of that come into play too. You know, getting those access, because you can almost imagine, except things have changed. Yeah, you're talking about donors and donor availability. If you look at it, the rate of, you know, incarceration of Blacks, African Americans is higher, and you consider those as vulnerable populations. So when you're looking at it in terms of access to donors, you know, those are a special population that you are not going to say because they are being incarcerated, then it's free for all and you have that kind of access to them. So even thinking along those lines too, you can almost imagine how it restricts potentially the number of available donors to, yeah. So those are the kind of, you know, studies, research that we should be looking at that look. Is it an improvement in the criminal justice system and an extension, you know, availability of more donors that we should be looking at, or it's just a mix of several different, you know, sectors that need to come together to make sure this happens.
And that's very interesting. And it kind of leads into a question I was going to ask around you know, there's a lot of focus obviously on improving transplant outcomes and advances in transplantation as a whole. But is there also emphasis on diversifying the donor registry itself, and how much of that gap can be filled with the donor registry versus trying to make sure that we can use different types of donors for these diverse patients as well?
Yeah, I think it really needs to be a multifaceted approach. I know that there are efforts to try to get more diverse populations on the registry as donors, and that effort certainly needs to continue, and you know, everybody's really enthusiastic about trying to do that, which is wonderful. But I think we also realize, you know, we really, the more diverse we become as a population and as a country, it likely will be harder and harder to find a match, you know, in the decades to come that's perfect. And so having those alternative, you know, family donors, cord blood donors, all of those different options is really critical to try to make our goal of having a donor available for every patient that needs it. So really, I think both things are critical. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Rafiq, as well.
No, I mean, I agree with you, and that's why the research, the advancement, the science needs to continue. And yes, you're seeing developments, you know, around cell therapy, around gene therapy, immunotherapy. Yes, so those are all different alternatives, because as we're seeing, donors and donor availability is not limitless. I mean, yes, it's not. So at some point, it will get saturated. So, and that's why you'd see advancement into other alternative forms of treatment that are equally effective, as, you know, the trials and research is showing.
Right. Yeah, that's a really important point to make. All these different alternative treatments where we're using our patient's own immune systems, right, instead of replacing it with somebody else's. We're using their own cells and genetically modifying them to correct the genetic defect. All of those things are also alternative ways to treat patients that don't require a donor. And really important to also consider, and I'm sure we're going to see major changes in that in the years to come, and may, you know, change our how we approach the registry and all of that moving forward.
There's so much to look forward to. Obviously, the field has come so far, and many of these gaps that were starker in the past are improving and starting to close, but clearly, there are some areas where we are still lagging, and, you know, need some additional attention. I'd love to hear each of your opinions on where you think research and clinical practice, sort of on both sides, where things should be focused to try to continue to make progress and close some of these gaps for racially and ethnically diverse patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think from my perspective, and just kind of taking on to Rafiq's really great points that he made earlier, it's really looking at the whole patient, the whole patient's journey, not just their journey of finding a donor and being in the hospital and getting chemotherapy and radiation and anything they need to make the actual transplantation process successful, but it's the referral patterns, it's the patient and caregiver support before and after transplant, it's insurance coverage and advocacy in that area. And then an area that's near and dear to my heart, because this is one of the major focuses of my research, is also continued health in the decades after transplant. So we also know that patients are at risk for a huge array of different long-term complications related to their transplant. And we need to make sure that they continue to have access to care and continual access to care even after that process is complete. So really, the research, the trials, the clinical care of the patient has to start at diagnosis of their disease even before we even start the conversations about transplant as a curative option, and then moving on for the rest of their life, because this is such a life-altering process, whether or not they go through transplantation, gene therapy, any other form of cellular therapy, there's always the potential for acute and chronic risks and complications.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more, Rachel. You know, it's just like pharmaceutical companies where you're doing, you know, you get a drug onto the market, you do your phase 3 trials, the phase 4 trials are continuous. I think it's for the lifespan of the medication. So, and I think it's a crucial part of it that, you know, with all due respect, the transplant is important, but I think equally, if not more important, is the post-transplant care. you know, because if we look at post, even pre-transplant related issues before the patient gets in, if it has to do with their neighborhood, if it has to do with nutrition, if it has to do with health literacy, if it has to do with, you know, going back to a job or not, if those things have not been addressed and the patient comes in, they get that transplant, they're going back to that same environment where things are not ideal, such that if we don't look at those aspects to post-transplant, you'd find out that the outcomes, the overall survival, relapse, the GVHD, there's every potential. I mean, every possibility that, you know, the patient doesn't do well. And, you know, they keep coming in for follow-up, and as a transplant physician, you're wondering, why isn't this patient getting better? I mean, they get their medications, their supplies, and so on and so forth, but still, the environment is not ideal for them to get better. So I think it's important to close that loop, as you said, Rachel, that post-transplant care too is very, very significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and another area of exciting research is also patient-reported outcomes, right? And I know there's an emphasis on that at the CIBMTR and NMDP. And as a clinician, I have an idea of what I think should or could or might be most important to the patient. But every patient's, you know, situation is different, right? And I don't think that we should or can make an assumption on how they feel and what should be prioritized for their care. So collecting that data, both clinically and in the research arena, is really important. And I know that it's now being embedded into almost every BMT-CTN trial, as well as other clinical trials in transplantation and oncology. So I think that, you know, having that trajectory of how the patients themselves are reporting their quality of life is also extremely important.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, they're the ones feeling the pinch and are going through the process. Who better to ask other than, you know, than them directly? So it's critical. I agree totally.
Absolutely. And thinking about how do we measure success in transplant, right? Are those success metrics just clinically important, you know, like quote unquote clinically important outcomes, or are they also what's important to the patient and what is their quality of life like after transplant? I think that that is a huge area of interest and focus for future research that is particularly important among racially and ethnically diverse populations who may, as you said, Dr. Yusuf, be going back to situations, you know, where their social determinants of health are less than ideal, and their long-term outcomes can certainly be affected by that.
Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for the second half of this episode, where our guests discuss the importance of personalized, coordinated care and the future of transplant.